Hi everyone, it's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers of Shaping the Future of Tech. Today, Lee Jacobs and Brian Balfour are joining me at AngelList HQ. Back in the day, Lee Jacobs was actually one of the first syndicate leads at AngelList, and he later went on to join the company as a partner. Prior to that, he started an education marketplace startup called Campus Doc. I actually got to know Lee at AngelList a few years ago. He was kind enough to help me craft my deck when I was out there raising my first fund. He's now a full-time investor of his own fund called Edelweiss, which he started with Brian Balfour, Elaine Weary, and Todd Masonis. Brian Balfour invests part-time at Edelweiss and spends a majority of his time as a CEO of Reforge, a professional education program for experienced practitioners. One of my teammates has actually gone through the program. It's great. Prior to Reforge, Brian was a VP at Growth at HubSpot, EIR at Trinity Ventures, and the founder of a few companies, including Boundless Learning, PopSignal, and Viximo. On the podcast, we chat all about VC. If you're thinking about raising a fund or maybe just curious about this weird world of venture capital, listen in. We chat about also Lee and Brian's favorite apps and tasty chocolate bars. I know, you didn't see that coming. But before I jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. The sexual wellness space is booming, but most innovation and investment has been focused on the body rather than the brain. Dipsy is changing that by taking a mind-first approach to female sexuality with an app for short, sexy audio stories, which makes sense considering 90% of women use mental framing to get turned on. The bite-sized audio stories are perfect for solo or couples, listening to set the mood, spark your imagination, and start intimate conversation. Head to dipsystories.com/producthunt, that's D-I-P-S-E-A, stories.com/producthunt, to download the iOS app. The first few stories are free. Introducing SpokaMeet, a new, incredibly easy-to-use video conferencing tool designed for small businesses. Featuring HD video and crystal clear audio, SpokaMeet just works. Join video conferencing in seconds with no download required, and you'll get unlimited meetings, unlimited recordings for only $11.99 a month. Secure and reliable with access from anywhere that you have an internet connection or phone connection, you're able to simply meet. Learn more at spoka.com, that's spelled S-P-O-K-A, and sign up for a free 30-day trial. All right, I'm here with Brian and Lee. How's it going, guys?
Hey.
Going well. Right. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming on. It's a headshot day at AngelList. So, of course, people on the podcast, listening to the podcast, will not see this flash that is, you know, disturbing us. But
I thought you were trying to throw us off and blind me and get me to, you know, say something stupid.
Yeah, that's actually the goal. That's okay. The goal of every podcast.
Right.
I've failed so far with all of the guests.
Question is what colored lasers are you going to put in the background? Photo?
I know. We should Photoshop something epic. So introduce yourself. Brian, I emailed you a long time ago, pre-Product Hunt, I think one day, and I was like, hey, do you want to meet me? I don't think I had an agenda, but I remember we met at a coffee shop. Probably
yeah.
6-7 years ago.
Yeah, it was quite a time ago. Yeah, I mean, my brief history is I started my first venture-backed company out of school. It was during the whole like social gaming craze, Facebook platform, Zynga, Farmville, all that kind of stuff. Did the whole like raise a ton of money and spent a ton of money. And we sold that company to Tapjoy, then did a second venture-backed company called Boundless Learning, where we were taking on the big textbook publishers to help college students. And then we succeeded in pissing off the textbook publishers enough that the three biggest ones ended up suing us. That kind of sucked. But we sold that company to a Czech competitor. And then I spent some time on the venture side as an EIR at Trinity Ventures, ended up as HubSpot as the VP of Growth, and now run a professional education company called Reforge. So that's been the twists and turns.
I'm not sure how we met, Ryan, but I think, you know, you were someone I knew of for a while, but I think we formally got to know each other at AngelList.
Mm-hmm. A couple years ago.
Yeah, we worked on a few interesting stuff together in collaboration. So yeah, my story was I moved to the Valley in 2010, started a company that did English learning online.
So you have a connection there in education.
But, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I've never actually
thought about that, but I guess I have. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
oh,
I
really?
Have. Yeah, right. I have. Yeah, I think, and we ended up investing in a bunch of education companies too. So I don't know if you know, but that's part of our thesis, Brian. So yeah, started an education company, spent that for about 2 years, but then decided that I loved like finding really smart, passionate people and getting them set up and raising capital, but I didn't want to run the business day to day anymore. So I decided to go into investing. So I raised a really small amount of capital from some family and friends and kind of got that started in around 2013. And as part of the process, a company that I invested in Brazil called Descomplica was having a Series A round that was pretty large Series A, and I couldn't figure out how to come up with $700,000 to invest in it. But Naval,
you didn't have some under your mattress.
I was looking really with a magnifying glass, and it just was. I came up with like 3 cents. No, but the truth is that, you know, at that time, Naval actually announced syndicates. And I was like, oh man, this is just a revolution. I saw it immediately. This is literally putting online what I had done offline. So I think it's a little debated within AngelList if I did the first or second syndicate, but we could look at the record. But I believe I say that I was one of the earliest people to do an angel syndicate, and it just, that bootstrapped my investing career. So I made a stop over at MHS Capital to learn how the pros did it and learned a lot from a guy named Mark Sugarman there. And then in 2015, I decided that I wanted to put together a small fund. I had known Brian from, I think, a mutual friend of ours, Nan Skolnick, who's been at Trinity Ventures. And he, you know, we got to talk. And then I had been good friends with Elaine Wary, who founded Mebo, and Todd Misonis, who founded Plaxo. And we'd been kind of trading deals together for a few years. So I brought all four of these really talented and very different people, which we'll talk about a little bit later, together and said, let's start a fund. So we started something called Edelweiss.
Where'd the name come from, actually?
Yeah, so Elaine and Todd started Dandelion Chocolate. So before, they had both done tech stuff, and they ended up starting a company called Dandelion Chocolate, which is here in the Mission and actually growing pretty quickly in Japan. And the dandelion flower is obviously a flower, and Edelweiss is a sister flower to that. And it grows really high on the tops of the Alps and is a really resilient flower and is very rare. So that's sort of one of the things that we've really been important to us, and we look at entrepreneurs or how resilient they are. It's also from the song. It's a very welcoming song and Sound of Music. So that's the
origin. We're going to get flower education on the podcast.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're aspiring botanists.
That's right. You and Michael Pollan. So, so we've invested upwards of around $10 million or so in the last few years altogether. We've done Wonder School and Pipeify and Kettle and Fire and a range of different companies. So, yeah, that's kind of my background.
It's interesting to hear that that's how you remember the story, because I remember the story. I mean, it's right, but it was actually much more meandering than that, because so I was in Boston for a number of years. I had done some angel investing. And when I came back to San Francisco, I was going to do some angel investing again. I remember sitting in Dolores Park with Lee, and Lee's just like, he's doing his Lee thing, telling me about the syndicate thing and like getting me all excited about it. I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. And we basically ended up, we were like, look, like, why don't we pool deal flow and money together and cut the work with Todd and Elaine. And so we just started with our own money, and that was the starting point.
That's right.
But then that actually ended up quickly, we did a couple deals, and then it quickly evolved into raising more like traditional LP capital. And then that evolved into doing more syndicates as well. So it's been multiple stages, and we've deployed how much money at this point?
Close to $10 million.
Yeah, close to $10 million. So started really small. So for those aspiring investors out there, like, you don't actually have to start like with like a $20 million fund or whatever, like, it can actually just evolve. And I think that's kind of what we did, is we just sort of like started investing, and it kind of evolved into this thing.
Brian has a better memory. That is actually how it happened. I guess for me, I always knew that I wanted to raise a fund. So
that's true. I feel like you are always have some like grandmaster plan that I only know 50% yeah, of. So yeah.
He's currently petting a cat right now. Like, he's got some sort of.
Yeah. What scheme. Can I say? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's the truth.
How did you, so when you, all four of you came together, and how did you decide kind of your process and also what you wanted to invest in? What was that conversation like?
Yeah.
So we did actually discuss those questions very specifically. I remember from the conversation, we went through a few iterations, but we eventually just ended up on like, hey, you know what? We're going to learn a lot. So why don't we just try to keep this as flexible as possible? And so we ended up coming with just like, I think what most people would call like a champion model, which is like anybody can sponsor the deal and, you know, fight for it really hard. And if they really want to do the deal, like we'll do the deal as a group. So no specific like majority vote or anything like that. But it, the purpose behind whatever we came up with was just to like keep it flexible and learn. And I think this was what Todd actually pushed us on this quite a bit. I think it's like a really smart thing to do is like when I think when you get into investing, you just you kind of learn like your style, your superpower, your focus, your advantage, your strategy, whatever it is. So just like keep it a little bit loose. At least that's how I remember the conversation. But apparently we remember conversations differently.
There's another element to that. So that's totally right. And Elaine and Todd specifically, they'd been around for a long time. Famously, Elad Gil was an intern at Plaxo. Elaine hired Kevin Nystrom. And, you know, they helped HipChat get started and a number of other – and they were early investors in Fitbit. And I think from there – what they noticed, and they're just generally super helpful people, and they just help anyway. And they said, huh, you know, if we had invested in all of our friends, we would do pretty well.
I've heard that pattern quite often among people in Silicon Valley, especially.
Yeah. So I think that's also a part of it. And one of our best investments came out of a relationship that Brian had known for a long time. This guy named Justin Mars, who I think you may know at Kettle and Fire. He was just like, look, he's a smart, really young, hungry guy, and we're just going to back him. And no one, I had no idea what bone broth was, by the way, when he told me what he was working on. I pretended. I said, yeah, that sounds cool.
I had to go Google it.
Okay. But I think that gets to the point, which is like, I think there's some investors out there that are very like super, super thesis driven. And then some who are like very people driven. I don't know, different strategies. But I think my take, the more that we do this is just like, we're not the best at like forming and finding the most interesting ideas in markets, like that's the operators, right? And so we've invested across a huge range of things and kept it flexible on purpose. And so far that's gone well. Obviously it'll play out over time, like a long period of time. But with so much interesting stuff going on and with technology disrupting all of these different industries, it's like I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know like how it's going to play out and like what opportunities. Like I think that at least that's been our style. It's just like, you know, and just, you know, let the entrepreneurs, let the people who have like an organic connection with, you know, those problem areas, like they're the ones that are going to navigate and find the interesting problems.
Yeah. I always say that I'm not talking to the customers out there. It's up to the entrepreneur. How do I have a point of view on what people want? My job is to evaluate the thinking of the person behind the entrepreneur and how passionately they see that problem and get me excited. So I try to, that's something I learned from Mark Sugarman, have a very open mind and build a business case from bottoms up. And the new best thing is going to come from who knows, but I think thesis driven is just not my style.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular questions or areas that you dive into when you meet a founder? Is there one or two questions that you always ask to assess some of those qualities?
Yeah, I always ask, you know, usually the people that I'm talking to are super smart and bright and have a lot of opportunities. So I always ask, you're super smart and bright. Why are you working on this? You could be working on so many other things.
Yeah, like, I ask that question a lot too.
Yeah.
And I find that the answer is sometimes very telling of their motivations. And sometimes it's just interesting. It elicits personal stories and questions. Yep. And I met with a founder yesterday, actually, and she illustrates founder market fit tremendously. And she got emotional, not in a rational sense by any means, but like very emotional and teared up about the problem she was trying to solve. And I was like, wow, like she's clearly bought in. She's not doing it to make money or, you know, for other reasons. She's doing it because she wants to solve this problem.
Yep.
Yeah. And I, the way that I frame that is like, so I asked the same question. And I think the question I'm always evaluating in my head is, do they have an organic connection with the problem or not? Like, so the opposite of that would be just like kind of like a spreadsheet business, right? Like somebody who's, if they tell a story
if
of like
0.1% of this trillion-dollar market.
Yeah. Or like, you know, I stumbled across, you know, this opportunity. It's just like, I just think it's like a massive market, right? And look, there have been successful companies built that way, no doubt. Right. I just think for us specifically, I think those that have more of the organic connection with the problem are the type of people that we enjoy working with. And so I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that question. It's, I think, more of a personal, it's more of a style thing. So,
Yeah. And that's something to a point we were talking about a little earlier is that it's, you know, product market fit is an idea, and then there's founder market fit, but I think there's investor strategy fit, and you have to find the right thing for you as a group that makes sense based on your unique skills and how you see the world. And nothing's right or wrong.
Investor strategy fit. I like that phrase. What is yours, and how has it maybe different in your team?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing is like really from a people perspective, do they have an organic connection with the problem that they're solving? I think the second thing just, so my background has all been in sort of this, what is now kind of labeled growth, but kind of the merging of basically what has happened over software and tech over the past 10 years is that the most powerful companies have moved from marketing and sales focused growth machines to product data and engineering focused growth machines. Like those are the levers that you actually pull on to like grow the company. I kind of stumbled into it and that's kind of what I focused on, but I think everybody kind of looks at companies through a different lens. And this is the lens that I look at things through. And what that's really about is like thinking about like, well, what are the inputs to growth of this business and how might they play out over time? So it's very easy for anybody to look at like LTV and cohort charts and CAC and like all that kind of stuff and say good, bad, whatever. The real question is not what they are today, but actually how might they evolve over time, depending on like what those levers and loops look like. And so that's...
Do you have an example of that? I have some assumptions, but like an example of maybe how those levers interact with each other.
I'll take the, since we only have a short period of time, I'll take the easiest one. And this is kind of just like a T-ball, but it's like, you know, a lot of people, I've seen a lot of pitches kind of walk in. They're like, oh, like we're growing at this rate. And, you know, they're using paid acquisition, which is not actually like some people are against it. I'm like, that's fine. They're like, our CAC to LTV numbers are this. And then they show me their projections. And it's really about just like scaling up the paid budget. But when you actually look at like a paid growth loop, almost always, unless you have network effects in the business, is that the steps and the levers of those loop get worse over time. And so like CAC increases, you end up acquiring lower and lower intent users, which hits your retention, your payback period, like all these things play out, right? And that's going to severely affect how the business grows. And so there needs to be another hypothesis in that business of like, okay, well, why do those economics actually stay the same or get better? Or how do we use this to leverage to another type of growth loop? And so evaluating those inputs and trying to like play it out over time, I don't know, it's just something I've spent almost my whole career on. And I feel like I'm still far from, you know, quote unquote, like mastering it, right? Or I don't, probably is no kind of concept of expertise or mastery there, but that just generally tends to be the lens that I look at things through, and a lot of the people in the Reforge like community tends to look at things through and focus on. And so, and those tend to be a lot of the conversations I have with our companies too and founders, and help them think through, because those are the ones that actually, if you don't get right, cause down rounds and dilution and sort of like all the nasty things. So
I think to summarize, Brian's investor strategy fit is where his unique skill set and the things he spent his entire career on can really add value to a company. And finding companies like that that that's where he's going to get unfair pricing and be able to get into deals that others wouldn't. So I think that's a really unique skill for Brian. For me, I think, you know, spending a lot of time at AngelList and seeing how fundraising works, having seen thousands and thousands of deals, I really dig in on fundraising and helping companies with their initial strategies around how to go to market and figure out how to position the story, and then helping them raise follow-on capital. And then I'm sort of a utility player in a lot of other ways, having been through it. I've been through a difficult co-founder breakup, which, you know, my co-founder, Kalingo, was one of my best men at my wedding. So it ended up being okay, but it couldn't have gone a different direction. Yeah. So I kind of have seen a lot of different things and help, you know, kind of be an ear to the entrepreneur and I think I help to build relationships with people quickly and try to go deep as quickly as possible.
The no-code space has matured quite a ton since I was a kid. I actually built my first website using Dreamweaver. Nowadays, you can build advanced web apps without writing code using Bubble. Bubble launched on Product Hunt back in 2015. Now more than 250,000 makers and companies have used Bubble to build marketplaces, social networks, CRMs, and more inside their browser. Check it out at bubble.is/producthunt to get started for free.
So you've worked with a lot of people raising funds, including myself, my first fund. You helped a lot with the pitch and the messaging and the deck and all those things.
I remember being like, you're going to definitely raise an awesome fund. Like, you don't need my help.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, whenever you do something for the first time, it's always, there's things that you know you don't know, and there's the unknown unknowns, and having someone that's gone through it before is really helpful. What are some of the maybe mistakes or tips, however you want to frame it, that you've seen kind of like first time fund managers make when they're raising a fund or just starting out as like a first time fund manager? Any patterns that you've noticed?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I'll think about all the things you did right, and then maybe the opposite would be the best thing. But I think you really positioned your value proposition and what you did around your entire career. I mean, I remember, you know, talking about building up a community and how I remember when Naval was so excited about buying Product Hunt, he talked about your superpower as one that was just engaging a group of people all over the world and building that in system in a scalable way. And I think that's a really rare thing. So I think when you go out, and I've seen this in your pitch, when you go out and try to find companies, you're very laser focused on like, can I actually help this company in this particular way? So I think, you know, that's on the right thing to do. On the opposite end of the spectrum is, you know, not being true to who the person is, whether she's a really awesome, you know, enterprise sales person and she wants to go focus on some and help in a totally different way. That is a strategy that's just probably not authentic. I think the key is figuring out who you are, what your investor strategy fit is, and designing a strategy and a way that you're going to get deal flow and what the right check sizes are going to be and what the portfolio construction is going to be based on who you are uniquely. So I think a lot of people just say, I'm going to go invest and give a bunch of people some money and it's going to be great, but they haven't necessarily thought through, you know, what the next order of things that come out of that.
Yeah, in some ways you can kind of describe as like, what are you selling if you're a product?
Totally.
If your fund's a product, what are you selling?
Totally.
And then how do you...
What's your value prop? Like, yeah. Like,
yeah. And you don't have to do everything, of course, but you need...
Well, no, that's the... Like, just like any product that tries to do everything, like, that's the disaster, yeah. Right? So you got to choose something.
Part of it's from a strategy perspective, but then part of it's from being different. Because right now there are so many early stage funds. In fact, on AngelList, we have over 130 funds running on the platform. And so there are more and more funds kind of in the marketplace. So how do you convince founders to take your money? You talked a little bit about your focus and kind of areas of focus and expertise, but how do you fight for deals? Like in a deal which is really competitive, I don't know. Do you have any stories you can share? Like,
yeah. Lee's a scrapper. he's a scrapper. And I think that's actually why we work so well together is like, I mean, look, like investing is actually a very time consuming thing. Like I'm a full-time operator. Investing is kind of a side enjoyment thing for me. And Todd and Lane are our other two partners are also full-time operators. And so for any operators out there who are also thinking about investing, I would highly encourage you to think about finding a partner who just has a totally different superpower than you. Because like Lee's superpower is like, yeah, he tends to connect with entrepreneurs and then scrap his way into things. And because it's a time-consuming game. So I don't know. You're on the front lines of that more than I am.
Yeah, I think for me, I tend to the thing that I love doing and my favorite, and you know, this changes and deal on a deal by deal basis, but find someone that's like, I remember Daria at VoiceOps, for example. Like it was clear to me that she was super, super smart and was going to do something interesting. And we took a pretty large, we were like, we're in. And we bet early. And then what I did was I made sure to help her throughout the entire process. And I think you do something similar, Ryan, where you help them kind of navigate the fundraising process. And since you've added so much value in such a short period of time, you know, you either introduce them to the lead or help them negotiate with the lead or introduce it to someone else who made an offer that gave them leverage with their lead. So that's like, I think, a really powerful strategy. And you end up being there, you know, if you introduce them to a lead, hopefully that lead's not going to cut you out of the deal. Because so I think that's one strategy. And
I would just go back to what we were talking about before. Just like think about yourself as a product. Like you're going to have to fight for your first customers no matter what you do, right? Like that's a given. But then the question is like, well, what if you were treating yourself as a product, what would you do? Well, you would do everything you could possibly could to make sure that you like make that customer successful so you have phenomenal word of mouth, right? And as the second that you have another founder, like going to another founder saying like, I would take Ryan's money any day of the week, that's going to make the process that much easier. Now the question is like, what is that thing you do for them that generates that word of mouth? Like going back to that value prop, right? You kind of have to think about yourself as a product and you're launching a product and like, what are the things that you would do in order to kind of, you know, get that initial base and then get the word of mouth going and then kind of build on top of that. And eventually it starts to build to a point where you're getting pulled into deals by other people. People are coming to you, like stuff like that. You still got to fight and all that kind of stuff. And constantly prove yourself and stuff, but it becomes those first few deals are a lot more energy, and then it gets a little bit easier over time, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I saw something recently, and Drews and Horowitz did this amazing thing where they were competing for a deal, and the founder just had like 10 emails in his inbox from very, very well-known people. And he was like, why is, call it Steve Jobs. It wasn't Steve Jobs, obviously, but the equivalent of something like that emailing me and telling me about and how great Andreessen Horowitz was like. I was like, I'm going to use that strategy. So in the last few things, I've actually started doing that, and it's great. Because as Brian said, this is a reputation business, and my thinking has always been to provide as much value as I can and don't ask for things in return and build a network of people that, I've helped because I love helping people. And then in turn, that comes back. And that's true about a lot of, in the last few years of my career.
Yeah, it's one of the most relationship-driven businesses that takes a long time to play out, both in the returns, but also in those relationships.
Yeah.
The people you might meet today might start a company in 5 years, and that one meeting or that one piece of help might get you into a deal or get you more visibility into other things.
One thing I learned from my time at AngelList was Naval would always talk about the long-term interest compounds and the value of thinking really long-term. And that's true about how you build your business, but how you build your network. So I've taken that to heart.
So what products do you love? This could be apps on your home screen or things you use.
Yeah. So I'll start with one. I was talking to my wife Becca this morning about it. I was like, Ryan asked about products. And so this is really more both of ours, but there's this product, you've probably seen it, called Gratitude Journal. The Gratitude Journal.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Gratitude Journal is the idea of every morning you're supposed to write down what you're grateful for in that given day. And there's science behind it, which effectively talks about how you're actually priming your brain to be positive and be an optimist, which is better than being a pessimist, it turns out. So I think there's a product maybe called the 5-Minute Gratitude Journal or something like that online.
Justin Kahn recommended that on one of the podcasts, actually.
Oh,
he uses that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So that's one that I think is really great. And then one that I've just been a fan of, I had some earlier, is our partners Todd and Elaine have this amazing bean to bar chocolate company called Dandelion Chocolate and the Mission. And they've basically applied everything they learned in the tech world to how to make it is the best possible chocolate, and they've won crazy awards around the world, and more people should know about Dandelion Chocolate. It's one of my favorites, and you can do a lot with it, hot chocolate or make treats and stuff like that. So
s'mores,
amazing s'mores. Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because I feel like I have, for being in tech, like I don't adopt it as many new products as like I feel like other people in the industry do. So like, I don't know, there's just very few things, but the two, one is crisp.ai. We operate as a distributed team, and sometimes I just get caught in meetings. I have a lot of background noise. And so what crisp.ai does is like, you turn it on, and it they use like machine learning and stuff to filter out like all the background noise, and it works remarkably well, And so like for any distributed team out there, highly recommend that one. And then I feel like a product that doesn't get as much coverage or not as many people talk about it is YouTube TV. Like I cut the cord and switched to YouTube TV. I love it. Huh. Like it's great. It's like $40 a month. The UI is just so much better. The recording on it is so much better. Like it knows when like Michigan basketball is ready to play, and just like, oh man, it's just so much better than any other Comcast or anything else out there. So obviously a big company product, but for some reason, like I feel like it doesn't get its fair share.
I had no idea.
Really?
No.
Yeah. Have you used it?
I've used it once. I think I registered for the trial and then set a calendar reminder to cancel because I wanted to watch something, some live TV. I can't remember what it was.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe it was a sports game.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm a sports person, so that's why. For me.
It's great for sports fans because I think it's $40 a month.
Yeah, it's $40 a month. The mobile app is great. The the web app is great. It's been awesome.
What kind of content deals do they have? Like, can you get HBO's? You can't get HBO.
No, not HBO. It's just like, it's all the major, like basically like live, non-premium channels.
Yeah, cool. I'm spread across Netflix, Hulu, HBO, Amazon Prime Video. And I think that's basically it, which probably adds up to around $40 a month as well. But I don't watch live content normally. Mm. I don't usually watch sports. So if I did, YouTube TV would probably be the right thing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to.
Well, wait, what about yours? You're the product. You're the product dude, so I feel like...
Probably gets asked that every day of his
life. Yeah, that's true. You probably have like 10 million things on your phone and computer.
Well, the funny thing is I have to remember, what have I shared on the podcast already? Because I don't remember myself. So actually one thing, Twitter. So there's an app called Twitter that I've been using.
No way. Tell me more.
I'm using the new Twitter beta. And have you seen it or played with it?
Oh, you're talking about like literally the spell the way it originally was, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I actually haven't played with the beta yet. No.
Yeah. So, you know, it's Twitter as you would expect. The big difference is that they're focusing on conversations as a clear priority for them. They want to really facilitate more conversation on Twitter. And from a business perspective, that makes sense. You know, one of the most engaging things within any kind of social software is when a person app mentions you or recognizes you in some way. And so the beta right now, it's using kind of this new threading UI instead of kind of a flat single thread kind of a UI. They've kind of taken more of a traditional forum like threading approach where you'll see a thread, of course, where someone tweets something, someone replies to that reply. And it allows you to dive deeper into certain conversations while still kind of being able to scan through the top level kind of replies. It's different. It's pretty subtle. I think it's an improvement overall, but it's nothing dramatic from my experience on Twitter. In fact, my favorite way of using Twitter, at least on the desktop, is TweetDeck by far. And that's actually pretty much the only way I use Twitter on desktop right now. And that's because it's like for power users. It's for weirdos like me. You can have multiple columns around all
kinds
of things.
You're a self-aware weirdo, which I like.
Yeah, self-aware. It's one of the reasons why I love Product Hunt, because I just love discovering and playing with these things. But yeah, TweetDeck is such a powerful tool for anyone building a company. I'm just surprised more people don't use it, because what it allows you to do is search for any keyword or any URL. So I have a column that surfaces any mention of Product Hunt. And I also include like misspellings. I also include the .com. So producthunt.com, Product Hunt is it's properly spelled. And that allows me to see what are people sharing? When are people complaining? What are people talking about? All those things. And so every day I get like this pulse of customer input and user input.
I quit Twitter at the beginning of the year, but now you're making me feel guilty. I feel like I need to do this for Reforge or something. So.
Actually, yeah. I actually search Reforge pretty frequently.
Oh, great. Well, so Lee is my tweet deck then. Yeah. let me know when something
all the
comes
insights
up.
Are, yeah. You know, $10 an insight.
Yeah. yeah. So, paid model.
Yeah.
Paid filter.
Yeah.
What made you quit Twitter?
I started thinking a lot about like emotional resilience. And like, I think that to our previous conversation, I think it's actually like a really important thing for a founder to build. And it was like something that I felt like I could get stronger at. And so one of the methods to do that was to like identify what are all of the triggers that basically send my mind down like an unproductive path or like consume some type of energy. And so the way you identify these triggers is just using like a lot of cognitive like behavioral stuff, kind of like the gratitude journal, but you're supposed to, there's specific questions and like specific type of journaling. And one of the triggers I ended up coming across was like after journaling for a little bit was like Twitter would be it would be like whether it was like a friend just sold this company for $500 million or, you know, some other kind of competitor like launched something or
a deal
something
we missed
nature.
Investing in. Is that worth $10 billion?
Yeah, it's just like all these things that can just that are just so easy to like get your mind sucked into. And so I was like, you know what, like this, like, so I tried quitting and I actually felt a lot better. Now the whole goal is to like you build enough resilience so like the triggers don't matter, but it's kind of like it's like a step like towards building that towards that. So anyways, yeah, for founders out there, like you're dealing with so much shit, right, that like you really got to be careful about like what you let, you know, your mind get consumed
The concept of like the information diet, what is, you know, we watch what we eat and we know that if we eat really bad food, it maybe we won't feel as well or look as good. And I think the same is true for Twitter and information. I'm not as strong as you, Brian.
Well, I've done a whole like content diet too. Like I don't read that much stuff anymore. Like I'll read like a few select things, but yeah, it's real. Like, I mean, you're a student of like Hooked and the Hooked method and the habit building. And it's real. You can use those things for productive or negative purposes. And sometimes they're within your control and not within your control. So you just have to be conscious of it. So, but it's hard. It's definitely hard.
So where can they find you if not on Twitter? Where do they go?
Yeah, so my website, I blog like maybe a couple times a month, brianbelfour.com. Or if you're interested in joining Reforge, I'd love to have you part of a cohort. And that's just at reforge.com. So those are my two places. So, and you can always email me, just brian@reforge.com. I'm always open to emails.
Nice. What about you, Lee?
I'm at Lee Jacobs on Twitter still.
Ooh, and your full name.
Yeah, I have leejacobs.co as a website.
Thanks for coming by. Good to
yeah,
see you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.